Okay, well, what the crisis means for socialists? Well, we have to start with what the crisis is, what it looks like and so on, what we're actually dealing with here. And I brought along my visual aid, which you probably can't read. From Edinburgh to Paris to Kiev, Europe is revolting. I don't know if any of you ever watch Media Watch, but one of the things they do is they find plagiarism. Now, I've got no problem with plagiarism myself. But they find plagiarism. I almost feel like I could get a highlighter out and highlight pretty much every line of this, and we could then run it in our magazine without changing it. I'm not suggesting we have to do this because they probably do take plagiarism seriously, but I think it indicates something about the way things have shifted with the onset of the global economic crisis. I want to begin, though, by reading you a quote. This is a quote from an article in the British newspaper, The Guardian. The Guardian is on the sort of smaller liberal left of British newspapers, hardly radical, though. And this is an account of one of the general strikes that have taken place in France this year. There have been a few of them. I think it gives you a real feel for some of the responses to the crisis already. You only had to walk alongside the demonstrators to realise the anger, even fury, felt by many people in France. As the demonstration hurtled along Boulevard Beaumarchais, protesters tagged bus stops with different variations on the same theme. Sarkozy, you're finished. Or two variations on general strike. Eternal strike and general insurrection. And my favourite, capitalism, you make us vomit. And also there's new graffiti. Painted white, can now be seen on most pavements in the streets of Paris. And again, I'm quoting from this article. It has sprung here and there in the last few weeks. The image is arresting. It is that of an old bearded man's face above the words, "It's coming." The man in question is Karl Marx, of course. Call it balderdash and political posturing or take it seriously. It all points to a recent trend in French politics, radicalisation. And I think as a little sign of some of that radicalisation in attitude, if not in street demonstrations as yet in Britain, reflected in The Guardian, what is this article called? A very impudent title, Three Strikes and You're Out, Sarko. And so I think there's these signs, and I'll try to draw some of them together just to give you a feel for the kind of crisis that we're dealing with. One of our sources, I think, should be those bastions of world capitalism, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, because throughout the global economic crisis, the International Monetary Fund has maintained that the world economy, or did maintain for a long period, that the world economy would continue to grow, but now they've given up on that. Now it's the euphemism falling growth, which I think means shrinking. On 11th of March, the IMF's managing director declared that the world is in the grip of what he dubbed the Great Recession, and he warned that this downturn will push millions of people into poverty and will cause civil unrest, his concerns. And yet recall that as recently as July last year, it seems an age away now, the IMF was still predicting world growth, not falling growth, actual growth, world growth would be cracking along at 4.3% a year. And since then, there have been a series of downward revisions, and by March 2009, last month, they were acknowledging, as was the World Bank, that the global economy is going to shrink for the first time since World War II. The World Bank says a 1.7% decline overall and 2.9% in the developed countries. A week later, the OECD, the Rich Nations Club, which is a bit more pessimistic, obviously, than the World Bank, released their figures. The Reserve Bank in Australia conceded that Australia cannot escape a 2009 recession and a sharp rise in unemployment at exactly the same time that the OECD dramatically downgraded its forecast. Now, remember I said before, the IMF in July last year was still predicting 4.3% growth. Now the OECD is forecasting that the developed world's economy will fall by 4.3% this year. The OECD also suggested its forecast that 25 million people could be thrown out of work in the developed countries could yet prove to be too optimistic. But one of its leaders, Mr. Schmidt-Hebel, argued, while some have dubbed this severe global downturn a great recession, he's not going along entirely with the IMF, it will remain far from turning into a repeat of the 1930s Great Depression, thanks to the quality and intensity of government policies that are currently being undertaken. So I'm sure you feel very relieved now. And yet the Great Recession is looking a lot like the Great Depression. This time around, though, there are some differences. The speculative bubble, for example, was bigger. If you look at what's happening with the housing market, the world's leading authority on the American housing market, Professor Robert Shiller of Yale, says that on a global scale, he's talking globally here, we have never yet seen such a big housing collapse. This is the biggest in history, so it's worse than the Great Depression. If you look at the stock market, this time there wasn't the huge one-off collapse that we saw in October 1929 on Wall Street, but in a series of aggregates of key indicators on the stock exchange, the falls in stock markets worldwide are now as bad or worse than they were during the Great Depression. World trade has now collapsed, suffering the biggest fall in 80 years, again, since the Great Depression. But the collapse this time around has come much more quickly, much more sharply. The flow of investment and finance around the world has dried up. 2 years ago, there was $1 trillion in net capital flows to what they call emerging markets, the developing world. This is now forecast, 2 years later, to be down 82%. That is, not it's 82% of what it was, it's down 82%, which basically means that the emerging market economies can't finance their foreign debt, their current account and government spending. Now, of course, many economists point out key differences with the Great Depression, particularly with the fact that governments this time have actually reacted, bailed out the banks, stimulated the economies, and so on. And this was not what happened in the 1930s. And it's certainly true that governments this time around have moved far more rapidly with these attempts at coordinated action. Also, unemployment rates at this stage, an important qualification, are significantly lower. But those unemployment rates are set to rise, and if you add in underemployment, discouraged job seekers, people who are working part-time but actually want to work full-time, the unemployment rate in the United States, for example, is effectively at least 16% even now. The final thing about the initiatives of the world's governments, because they have taken these initiatives, they have attempted to intervene, to prop things up and so on, but the massive financial stimulus, the banking bailouts and so on, they're yet to make a huge amount of difference, and in some senses, they engender the seeds of further problems. For example, we've got a situation now where governments are going to be looking to raise an unprecedented level of debt to fund the stimulus packages, the bailouts and so on. And the figures are very rubbery here, once you get into the trillions, it all becomes a bit loose. About $4 trillion by the advanced nations alone, and it's being acknowledged by the World Bank and the IMF that that will essentially crowd out finance again to the developing world and what they call emerging markets. And in human terms, what does that mean? It means mass hunger, poverty. We've got an article in the New Magazine about the hundreds of thousands of people who will die, would not otherwise have died in the period between 2009 and 2015. Between 200 and 400,000 people extra, above those who would just normally die because of capitalism, those hundreds of thousands of people extra will die, and one of the reasons is because what trickle of money ended up in the developing world is going to be further cut back. Mass hunger and poverty because they basically won't be able to get any money. And then, of course, there's serious questions being raised about whether even advanced Western nations will be able to raise all the money that they want to. Some of you may have, like me, learnt a new phrase the other week, quantitative easing. Yes, the euphemisms abound. It means printing money, basically. And you're probably going to learn new phrases and new euphemisms week in and week out. We're probably heading for a government debt crisis and a national debt crisis on a global scale that will be unprecedented. And that's just a really brief overview of some of the things that are actually happening insofar as we can keep track of them. The ruling class themselves, such as the anarchy of capitalism, can't themselves keep track of it. That's just a bit of an idea of how things are going, what it means in human terms, as well as the kind of the dry economic statistics. But, of course, no event in capitalism just takes place in some dry economic statistical sense. There's always ideological turmoil that goes along with this, and it's that I want to turn to now. I think everywhere in the world, the global economic crisis has had an immense impact on consciousness, that you really would have to be asleep not to have noticed what's going on And you really would have to be a totally blockheaded supporter of the system and a supporter of the neoliberal ideology of the system not to feel things have been shaken up. It is not as it was. And there's this immediate impact on consciousness, I think, that we can see in varying degrees around the world. I'll give you a few examples from the United States. Because the US, I think it's interesting, it's not like if you look at the US, you see, like we've seen in France, you know, the general strike after general strike in the course of a few months. We're not seeing that in the United States yet. But the US is very advanced, I think, in ideological turmoil. And we can see it in a range of places. I think one of my favourite examples is the American comedian Jon Stewart. He has a TV show called The Daily Show, which I recommend watching if you're after a bit of sort of political humour. He's not always that political. But he's made a bit of a name for himself in the last little while by mocking the financial advisors who were basically saying to people, put your money into hedge funds, best earns, there's a good investment, and so on. And he particularly was going for the financial advisors on the competing network CNBC, who, in his words, showed us how to make $1 million if you had $100 million to start with. He showed footage of CNBC's Jim Cramer enthusiastically urging viewers to buy shares in Bear Stearns just before it crashed in March 2008. And I think Cramer's craziness, the whole thing of, you know, get out there, buy, this is a great investment, is a really dramatic illustration of Karl Marx's observation of the capitalist mentality. Business is always thoroughly sound and the campaign in full swing until the sudden intervention of the collapse. But it's not just Jon Stewart, who's got a bit of a reputation as a sort of left liberal type. Even conservative TV comedians such as Jay Leno are making fun of capitalism. And this is what he had to say in one of his programs. In a stunning announcement, Citigroup showed a profit and had its best quarter since 2007. They made $8 billion in profit. That just goes to show you, you give a company $45 billion in government bailout money and they'll show you how to turn it into $8 billion. And the clincher, see, this is capitalism. Now, I think that, you know, they're just little indicators of, I think, a quite widespread ideological turmoil in the United States. Another example of it, the way that the White House, when they were deciding about the original, so small, $700 billion bailout for Wall Street, the way the White House was flooded with emails by working class people basically saying, how dare you, don't give the money to those robbers. Now, in these terms, in Australia, as in the terms of the actual working through of the economic crisis itself, it's early days yet. But I think everywhere neoliberalism is basically gone, even by its greatest defenders. I never thought that. I never agreed with that stuff. No. But there are also early signs, I think, that what we might call neo-Keynesianism, the idea that the stimulus package, the bailouts and so on, this is going to be welcomed with open arms by the mass of the population. As I said, with those emails coming into the White House, there's already signs that that's not going to cut it. One writer talked about, was this Obama's Katrina moment? That is the moment where he stood by as a terrible disaster took place and was seen by those who expected better from him not to be able to do anything. I'll use some American TV examples. Bob Schieffer of CBS asked Lawrence Summers, who's Obama's chief economic advisor, a very simple question that has haunted the American public since the bailouts began last year. He said, do you know, Dr. Summers, what the banks have done with all of this money that has been funneled to them through these bailouts? And then Schieffer the writer goes back to say, what followed was a monologue of evasion that, translated into English, amounted to, not really, but you little folk needn't worry about it. But it went on. Summers was even more high-handed in addressing the retention bonuses, so-called, that had been handed to the very bosses who brokered all the bad bets. After reciting the requisite outrage, he delivered a patronising lecture to viewers of ABC's This Week on how our tradition of upholding law made it impossible to abrogate the bonus agreements. It's all the law. It's all been done. We've got this agreement. You can't possibly do anything about it. I'm terribly sorry. Of course, we don't like it. But again, the writer goes on to say, it never occurred to Summers that American workers might know that contracts are renegotiated all the time, most conspicuously of late by the United Automobile Workers, which consented to givebacks as its contribution to the Detroit bailout plan. The final thing I want to say is just in terms of this ideological turmoil, because I don't think we can overstate this. The scale of the rupture, a generational turning point in consciousness. This is not just another blip on the radar of that, you know, we've had recession in the early 80s, another recession in the early 90s, in much of the world, another recession in, or much of East Asia, another recession in the late 90s, in the US and a range of places in Europe, a recession in 2000. None of them caused this kind of ideological turmoil. I think we're dealing with something that's qualitatively different. It's in a way a generational turning point in consciousness. In the same way I think that the Great Depression was, or World War One, or the post-war boom, that these all fueled a certain view of capitalism for those who were affected by them, who lived through them. And I think it's not just socialists who say this. Again, this is an article again from the British Guardian on the 21st of March this year. And the article was entitled, Is It 1929? Okay, well, that all, you know why they say 1929. Is it 1929 or 1989? Why 1989? I'll read you a little bit of what they say. At the start of the crisis, many people likened it to the recessions of 1982 or 1973, which was reassuring because both dates refer to classical cyclical downturns. I think that's actually wrong about 73, but you get the point. Yet 2008 to 2009, like 1989, may very well correspond to an epochal change whose unfolding consequences will be felt for decades. The end of the East-West ideological divide and the end of absolute faith in markets are historical turning points. And I think that's actually really quite accurate. So, where to now? Well, I think as well as looking at the ideological turmoil, we've got to look at sort of what's our take on this. And I think there it means we have to go back to very fundamental questions, the reasons for the crisis, that is, that the problem is capitalism and not just, as our own Prime Minister would have it, some extreme or cowboy version of capitalism. Rudd can huff and puff all he likes about extreme or cowboy capitalism, or that neoliberalism, that particular variant of capitalism that now no one ever has supported, that was to blame. He can proclaim that all it needs is a few regulations of the market to put it all right. But the truth is that the system he's committed to saving is fundamentally stuffed. Karl Marx dedicated his life to explaining how capitalism works, showing that it could never provide for all of humanity and it would always, no matter how long or high it boomed, eventually descend into terrible crises. Today we're seeing one of those crises developing with immense speed. I think the madness of capitalism, the way this is not just some ideology of neoliberalism, whatever, the madness of capitalism was highlighted by something that we published this in our magazine. It's from the US Congressional Budget Office, which estimated that there will be at least a 6.8% difference between what the US economy is capable of producing and what it will produce over the next 2 years. That's the equivalent of $2.1 trillion in lost production. And that's what recession means. The capacity to produce things that people actually need is irrelevant. What matters is profits. And the capitalists aren't investing because they're worried they won't make enough on their money to risk it. And the true state of employment, as I mentioned before, in country after country, doesn't capture the totality of workers' suffering because employers are forcing workers to work fewer hours and so on to prop up their profits. Okay, so I've mentioned the ideological turmoil, but I want to move now to resistance because resistance can arise out of this crisis. I mentioned at the beginning the concerns of the spokespeople of the IMF that this would create civil unrest. And they're not alone. The bosses know that their system going into crisis can create resistance. Dennis Blair, who's the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, made a speech to various Congress people, actually, about what the economic crisis meant in security terms. And he was quite blunt with them. He said, basically, forget all that stuff we used to go on about terrorism and the war on terror and the Muslims under the bed. Forget all that. That's all nonsense. It always was. What you've got to get your heads around now is the fact that the greatest threat to world security is the world economic crisis and the fact that people might resist it. He actually got quite a bad hearing. They didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to know, because actually the war on terror and all that stuff, well, yeah, that's useful and you can sort of mess around with it. But the world economy going into crisis, they knew that there was nothing they could do about it. They didn't want to hear the very accurate predictions, I think, of Dennis Blair. And of course, we've seen examples already of the resistance that can arise out of the crisis. Think about places like Iceland, Latvia, Hungary. Actually, there's been quite explosive resistance in countries like that. You think about somewhere like Iceland, had very little unemployment, one of the richest countries in the world, but the explosion took place there for specific reasons to do with Iceland, the centre of the world financial system. And as the crisis began with financial turmoil, Iceland was one of the first and hardest hit. And so you see a situation where there's demonstrations day in and day out in the Icelandic winter, which I imagine is pretty cold, for about 2 weeks, and the government is brought down. Latvia or Hungary were already very indebted, and so the financial crisis had a much sharper impact on them, and there was resistance, demonstrations, riots and so on within pretty short order. Then France, that I mentioned earlier, Italy, Greece, we've got a comrade from Greece here over the weekend. I'm sure lots of you have heard about the inspiring events of resistance by workers and students, strikes, student occupations, demonstrations and so on, against what the government is threatening to do. In these countries, governments have pretty much immediately threatened assaults on pension plans, public sector jobs and or wages. The article I began with, the three strikes and you're out, Sarko, said the French weren't protesting at the recession. They were instead focusing their anger on the way that Nicolas Sarkozy is dealing with the recession. And 75% of French people in an opinion poll at the time of the general strikes were in agreement with the strike and against Sarkozy. Again, I can't resist repeating the figure about boss napping. A initially French phenomenon, but one that I'm sure will leap national boundaries, that 48% of people polled in France supported boss napping, and a majority of blue-collar workers supported it. And then, of course, there is a resistance in Ireland. I think it's worth saying a little bit more about Ireland, because the examples I've given so far of resistance are far away from our experience here. I think, as I said, the ideological turmoil in Australia hasn't hit the kind of levels it's hit in the United States, and certainly the resistance on the streets is nowhere like any of this. Let's look at Ireland, because Ireland has had some of the similar things that we've seen in continental Europe. There's been massive strikes, 120,000 people on the streets of Dublin. It's a city of only 2 million. There have been factory occupations, some of them successful, some of them ongoing. There's been a level of explosive struggle in an economy that looks a lot more like Australia, an economy that was the great boom. You know, you're probably all sick of hearing John Howard going on about, you know, we haven't had a recession since the early 1990s, aren't we the greatest managers in the world, and so on. Well, actually, Ireland was a bit the same. It had also, as well as a long period of boom, the benefits of which didn't go to workers, as they didn't here, it also had a trade union bureaucracy that was totally craven, that wouldn't stand up and fight. It had, therefore, a falling level of union membership, falling level of industrial struggle, and so on. And yet, the government announced that they were going to do a few things. They took a step too far, and there was an explosion. The final thing I want to say about resistance is that the resistance itself has ideological effects. It means that there's a possibility of socialist ideas getting a wide hearing in certain circumstances. And I think the best example, obviously, is what's happening in France, where the far-left candidate for the presidency in the last election is now, on current opinion polls, the second most popular political figure in the country. And I was going to read you a little bit about what he said, just to give you an idea of what it is that got popular, if I can find it. And possibly... I can't find it. But let me assure you that he's not popular because he's saying, let's all show restraint, pull together, wait, be calm, and so on. He's saying, basically, the system doesn't deserve to keep living. Okay, but none of these responses, the struggle, the ideological turmoil, are automatic. that all of them can take time, and there's a possibility of polarisation and the growth even of left-wing and right-wing ideas at the same time. So I want to talk now about Australia, because so far what I've talked about, none of that really applies here. The ideological turmoil applies, but not in anything like the extent in the US. But Australia won't be exempt, even though the economic crisis hasn't fully hit as yet compared to some other places. It's early days. And actually, we should remind ourselves that an economy structured like Australia's, very dependent on world trade and the world economy, can mean that when the crisis does hit, the effect of the crisis can be worse given the nature of the economy and the already steep decline in world trade. That was certainly the case in the Great Depression in Australia, where Australia was one of the worst hit for exactly those reasons. We have some idea of what the Australian bosses are capable of when a recession hits. You look here in Victoria, I think it's the best example. The last recession, the early 1990s, Jeff Kennett was the response. Privatise everything, slash everything, attack the working class and so on. And that was one of those periodical blips on the radar in terms of capitalism. This is going to be worse. And so we can have a situation of contradictory consciousness where workers, as they do in Australia, I think, at the moment, largely can accept wage restraint as perhaps unpleasant but necessary because it's the only way we're going to save jobs. We don't see any alternative. On the other hand, they can really hate the massive CEO payouts. And so we get that contradiction, I think, really strongly expressed here in Australia. The ruling class recognises the contradictions. That's why they're so keen to quarantine capitalism as a system from the blame. That's why it's always extreme capitalism, it's neoliberalism, it's cowboy capitalism, whatever. I thought actually Barack Obama's attack on CEO payouts summed up this, it's not really capitalism that's the problem, it's just a little thing we're going through. He said this, it's about he had to position himself as being angry about the CEO payouts. In fact, he had a bit of a problem because he didn't position himself as angry enough initially, but he worked it out. He said, at the same time, the rest of us can't afford to demonise every investor or entrepreneur who seeks to make a profit. That drive is what has always fuelled our prosperity, and it is ultimately what will get these banks lending and our economy moving once more. And I think that argument is, in a way, the key argument that revolutionary socialists are up against. So what do we got to do? The first thing we have to do is to intervene in any way we can in the ideological turmoil as neoliberalism becomes a dirty word. A space has been opened up to a greater or lesser extent, depending on how the crisis has played out from country to country. A space has been opened up for Marxist analyses to be taken more seriously. And even the mainstream media have felt compelled to give a little space at least to Karl Marx's economic analysis, to mention his name more than they did and so on. And to people who are attracted to left-wing ideas, I'm not saying that the crisis is necessarily going to attract people to being a socialist, but to people who are attracted to left-wing ideas, who think there's something wrong with the world, whatever the issue is that gets them going, the crisis provides an opportunity to present the full indictment of capitalism and the full case for a socialist alternative in a way that really hasn't been the case for a very long time. Now, propaganda alone is clearly not enough. For an organisation the size of Socialist Alternative, it's the lifeblood of our organisation because it's something that we can do and have to do at every opportunity. But the pain caused by the recession can lead to resistance. There'll be many occasions in which bitter grumbling by people will not turn into active defiance, particularly given the failure of unions nationally to provide any lead. But the very character of the crisis means that any acts of resistance have the capacity to generalise. So we have to be not hanging out waiting for them, but noticing things when they happen and jumping on them. They are grist to our mill. They're arguments to make, again, about the nature of the system. Because the blame can't, as it could in the recessions of the mid-70s or the early 80s, be deflected onto, oh, it's the oil-rich nations raising the cost of oil too much, or it's the strong unions, if only that was the case. But because the immediate trigger has been the behaviour of the banks, the opening for explicitly anti-capitalist arguments, I think, are so much greater. And resistance around one aspect or other of the crisis can take on an anti-capitalist character. Events elsewhere, as I've illustrated, can give a glimpse of the potential, and we can confidently say that Australia will not be immune. But what are we looking for? We're not just waiting for things to happen. All of these issues are out there and they're impacting on people in some way or other. If we don't actively try and find those people and prosecute those arguments, we're wasting an opportunity. But we're also wrong, I think, too, if we think we're just looking, waiting for economic struggles. If we're just waiting for strikes or that this is how the crisis is going to work its way through. If we're looking there, we'll not be looking at other things that may well happen. If you look back to the Great Depression, in Australia, as in many countries, there was a very low level of strikes in the first years. The stuffing was knocked out of the union movement. But political struggles arose very quickly, out of governments going too far, or a response to the rise of the right. You think about the sacking of Jack Lang, his resistance to the Premier's plan, the sacking of Lang, the fact that hundreds of thousands of people came out to protest about that and would have gone further if there'd been a lead from anyone with any credibility in the workers' movement. That happened at a time that the level of industrial struggle in New South Wales was very, very low. The growth of the socialisation units in the Labor Party, the rise of populist movements in the United States, the Battle of Cable Street in Britain in the early 1930s against the fascists. There's all sorts of political possibilities that can arise out of this as well. So looking only for strikes and workplace resistance forgets that there are two sides in the class struggle. What governments do, or the rise of political movements like fascism, can spark a fight long before workers feel industrially confident. Or a single spark at some workplace can unleash the pent-up bitterness, as has happened in a range of countries in Europe. We don't know, and there's no point at all in speculating, which form this thing will take. But I want to go back, before I finish, the example of Ireland, because I think it's the most like the Australian situation. It's a case where the bosses and the government just went a bit too far, a bit too fast. And that could overcome the fear, the demoralisation, the atomisation in the working class after decades of low strike figures and union leader inactivity or sellouts. Because the crisis, when it hits, can overwhelm governments and they can overreact, they can generalise the resistance because they've gone too far with across-the-board pay cuts or attacks on social services that people feel this is too important, this is too essential for us to let go without a fight. It's not like there are all these left-wing union leaders in Ireland that led this, far from it. And then, of course, when the mass of workers do start to move into struggle, the question of what politics dominate becomes essential. Think about the situation at the moment in Australia. Rudd's popularity is at an all-time high with both bosses and workers, but I think for very different reasons. But he won't be able to please both sides of the class divide, even in the medium term. And there's no prizes for guessing which side he will be pleasing as the crisis bites harder. You look at how working class hostility to work choices was channeled into electing the Labor Party. Now that Labor's in office and is likely to have to oversee potentially severe attacks on workers' living standards, the space may open up amongst a minority of students and young workers for socialist alternatives to managing the crisis in the boss's interests. And then the questions will be posed more sharply than they are at the moment. How many socialists are organised? How clear are they about uncompromising hostility to the system? How well can they win people to their arguments? And none of this can start when the struggle breaks out. It starts today for current members and also for all of those who are thinking of becoming members as well.